the presentation content and turn it over to Bill Denman from EPA Region 4 to officially begin today's session. Bill?
Oh, thank you, Jean. I really appreciate all that information. And if any of you do have any trouble, like Jean said, just type a question in and she can usually get you hooked up. So thanks so much for getting us set up and getting us ready to go here. I'm very excited about today's webinar. My name is Bill Denman, as Jean said, and I'm in Region 4. I'm currently chief of the Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch in the Land Chemicals and Redevelopment Division, where I manage the Brownfields Program, as well as chemical safety and sustainability programs in Region 4. But I have a long history in working in the Superfund program, and specifically in Superfund redevelopment. And so I'm very excited about today's presentation. And currently, I'm on a detail working with Frank Avasado up in headquarters. So if those of you are familiar with the Superfund redevelopment program, if you've been on our website, viewed our content, Frank is responsible for most of that. And, you know, Frank, we really appreciate all the work that you do to support and to implement the Superfund redevelopment program. Just the content on the web is fantastic. So with that, today we'll be joined by Michael Goldstein, managing shareholder of the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm. And if any of you have attended National Brownfields Conferences or maybe the Florida Brownfields Conference or Southeast Brownfields Conference, you may have had the opportunity to hear Michael speak. I'm very excited about this. We're very honored that Michael agreed to come today and talk to us and get his perspective on redeveloping contaminated properties from the attorney and developer's perspective. So here's an overview of what we'll be talking about today. We're going to go through a brief introduction that I'm doing now, and then we'll turn it over to Michael, who will have the majority of the presentation today. He'll present on why he thinks there's such an intense interest in Superfund site redevelopment. And then we've allowed a good bit of time for Q&A because we thought a lot of people, after listening to the presentation, would have some questions. And we have myself and some other folks from EPA and Michael that are available to answer your questions. So as you're going through, make sure and get those questions in so that at the end we can go through those. So just a little bit about the Superfund Redevelopment Program. The Superfund Redevelopment Program works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options in the cleanup process at Superfund sites. So one of the important things to note here is that this can be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. We try to do it as early as we can, but that doesn't always happen, and you know, we can always consider reuse and look at how the cleanup is being implemented or has been implemented and work with developers, local governments, interested parties in redeveloping those properties. No two sites are the same. As any of you who have worked in this business know, contaminated sites pose unique challenges, and there are some additional things that people have to work through. But usually, you know, when people go through this process and get to the other end, they realize what a benefit having gone through that is, and now they, you know, they're very well aware of what the environmental condition is, what the limitations of the property may be, and how their redevelopment is supported there. So we have a couple pictures here. On the top left-hand corner, back in September, just recently, EPA Administrator Wheeler visited the Carter Carburetor site in St. Louis to recognize EPA and local stakeholder collaboration that facilitated the Boys and Girls Club of Greater St. Louis acquisition of the property. So that was one that we're particularly proud of. And on the right there, you can see where the Superfund Redevelopment Program worked at the Nansemond Ordnance Depot and Atlantic Wood Industry Superfund sites as examples of how we work together with state, local, tribal, and private stakeholders to clean up hazardous waste sites that lead to economic investments and positive environmental outcomes. We actually have a video developed for that. So I encourage you to click on that link there, which you'll see the link has Superfund Redevelopment Initiative in it. We're changing our name to Superfund Redevelopment Program because we've been around for many years, and it's felt that we're definitely part of the cleanup process now, and not just an initiative. So I really encourage you to go to that website and take a look at the resources that Frank has put up there and developed to promote redevelopment. There's success stories, economic information, videos, just a lot of really good information. One of the other things that's on that website that's linked to are the partnerships that we have developed. We have partnerships with the Rails to Trails Conservancy, with the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the Trust for Public Land, and the Pollinator Partnership, and are working on developing partnerships with other entities, specifically other land trusts. And I encourage you to go and check out some of those. It's really interesting, some of the things that these people can either help happen at a Superfund site or, like in the case of the Academy of Model Aeronautics, where people that fly model airplanes can use some of the land that's been cleaned up to promote this activity. So now, again, I would recommend or encourage everyone to start, you know, submitting your questions as we go through this presentation. We'll be monitoring that, and we'll, you know, like I said, have allowed for a decent amount of time at the end to answer questions. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and get started. I'd like to introduce Michael Goldstein. As I said, Michael is the managing shareholder of the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm. Michael and I have worked together for many years. When I was a Superfund project manager, I worked primarily on sites in Florida, and our paths crossed many times, either at the Florida Brownfields Conference, talking about redevelopment of Superfund sites, or, you know, working with some of his clients to get some of the work done. But Michael represents developers who are interested in redeveloping properties, and he's a master at helping them navigate through the complicated world of regulatory issues, including those that deal with contaminated properties. And it's really just an icon in the state of Florida and really throughout the country in helping promote the redevelopment of contaminated land. And I just can't tell you how excited I am that we have Michael today to talk. I've been looking forward to this webinar now for several weeks. And it's always a pleasure to get his perspective on what's going on in the redevelopment world and some of the ways that he's helping to promote redevelopment of contaminated land, both from the side of being an attorney that represents developers and also being the manager of a development fund that's looking to redevelop contaminated land. So, Michael, thank you so much for presenting today. And with that, I will turn it over to you to get started.
Bill, thank you so much. I am exceedingly happy that this day has arrived. I know a lot of us have been working very hard to bring all of these experienced folks together and to generate a lot of interest, and I can see that we have hundreds of folks on the line. So this is a wonderful forum to talk about an important project, an important opportunity, not just in our state, not just regionally, but across the country, and we're going to dig in and see how all of that is playing out in real time. Bill, thank you for allowing me to speak. Frank, Kat, Josie, others. It's a very humbling experience to be able to speak on behalf of thousands and thousands of folks who are actively using this program that has been around now for not just 20 years, which is the date reflected on the anniversary report, but 21 years. We're on our 21st year of Superfund redevelopment. It's truly no longer an initiative, but a program. It has staying power. And there are a lot of perspectives I want to bring to the table here. And the first one is this: from an overall view, there are lots of resources and case studies and bright, shiny objects in the toolbox that EPA has created. But these are more than just museum pieces. Environmental lawyers in particular have It's almost a fetish how much we love diving into and exploring the guidance documents and the case studies that EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program makes available. But when you take them out and you use them, you can see that they are practical, constructed for heavy use, and that they work. And if it's anything that one should take from this presentation, it's that the program works, that dollars that are invested in a Superfund redevelopment project are not only going to be returned to their investors, but returned with interest. And in addition to the equity that gets created for private principals, there is a significant amount of community equity that's also created for local residents and neighborhood stakeholders and local government. So there's a lot about this program that recommends itself. We're going to get into all of that. Just a quick word about myself to pick up on something that Bill said. I wear, at this point in my career, a number of hats. I come to the table as a 28-year environmental lawyer, someone who has been helping private developers and local governments and lenders and not-for-profits and individuals and entrepreneurs and community groups figure out how to safely acquire, clean up, reuse, and lift communities around contaminated sites. It's been a long, interesting, and very productive ride, mainly because of the way in which EPA and its state regulatory partners keep on reinventing themselves and expanding the toolbox that's available to lower the cost and manage the exposure to environmental, regulatory, and third-party risk associated with environmental redevelopment. Along the way, as an environmental attorney, and for those of a certain age who came of age in the 70s and may remember the old Remington Razor commercial where the owner would come out and say, I like the razor so much I bought the company. That was my experience as well, working in environmental redevelopment as an advisor and as a counselor. There was so much good that was being brought into existence in terms of accelerated cleanups and public health protection and job creation and a profitable model that I decided to become involved in the arena, not just as an advisor, but as a principal, engaging in brownfields redevelopment on a one-off basis, on an intermittent basis as opportunities presented themselves, and then over time more programmatically, more strategically, and now very much strategically pursuant to a fund that we're raising, which EPA has asked me to speak about, and we're going to speak about the fund and our commitment to the Superfund program. So in preparing my remarks, in curating some of the guidance documents and resources and tools that EPA has made available through the Superfund redevelopment program, I've attempted to do all of that as someone who supports redevelopment from a counselor position and also from the perspective of someone who's intimately involved as a principal and who has a fiduciary obligation to protect capital and to return, to create a significant return on investment from those who believe in us and invest in our fund. With all of that as setting the stage, I want generally with respect to who I am and the way in which I look at today's presentation, I want to spend just a few more moments setting the stage of where this presentation will go and giving you the roadmap. What we're going to do initially is we're going to talk about the value of the Brownfields program generally, why and how the concept appeals to the development community generally. That's a baseline level of knowledge many of us on the phone have, but there are lots of newbies to this conversation that are dipping their toe in the pool, and they likely have sites that they could be responsible for, are responsible for, or feel challenged by, where they want to pursue redevelopment and are wondering if this is a safe undertaking. So we're going to try to create a baseline level of knowledge. We're going to discuss next some of the larger trends and smaller cross currents influencing decisions on how, where, and when to invest in impaired site development. And at that point, we're going to take a deep, deep dive, very granular, into the Superfund redevelopment program. I'm going to do that as follows. We're going to highlight key resources, case studies, and practices. There is so much good material on EPA's website that if you haven't navigated it before, it's easy to become overwhelmed. So I've tried to curate the key documents and links that should matter to you, because whether I'm counseling clients in my day job as an environmental lawyer or looking at opportunities as a principal with a fiduciary obligation to my partners, they matter to me. They guide me, they inspire me, and they help me create better outcomes. And I believe these resources and case studies and practices that I've highlighted will do all of these things and more for you too. We're going to emphasize the key steps and sequencing the steps that should be taken to be orderly, efficient, and thorough in this arena, to not miss anything. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about Superfund redevelopment planning. Planning, 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 before getting too deep into a project and making commitments and creating expectations that may not bear out from a technical perspective, a land use perspective, a community acceptability perspective, a legal perspective, or an economic perspective. Of all of the types of resources that EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program has made available, the planning resources are the lowest hanging fruit, the most readily accessible, and when properly used, the most likely to produce not just the intended outcomes, but superior outcomes. Next, because I'm a lawyer and I can't help myself, but also because liability lies at the beating heart of Superfund as a statutory scheme, we're going to spend some time talking about the almost embarrassing abundance of options that exist to insulate Superfund projects from legal risk. These options are statutory in nature and administrative in nature, but there are also market-based solutions as well. I'm going to touch on those. We're next going to talk about the larger community in which these projects exist and the opportunity, really the imperative to ensure that the combination of public resources and private investment rewards not only development principals and their investors, but a broader universe of stakeholders, parties who are or who may be connected to a site and a place by history, by blood, by culture, by the ways in which they lived and the ways in which they died in a particular neighborhood. We want to lift those parties too. We want their situations elevated so they have access to more economic opportunity, a better quality of life, and either directly or indirectly, meaningful and lasting equity in the success of a project. And then finally, because EPA specifically asked me to speak to this issue, we're going to talk about our fund, Goldstein-Kite Environmental Redevelopment Partners. And the big bet, we think it's a safe bet, we're making on the Superfund Redevelopment Program to do good, well, to help us do good, as measured in environmental, public health, community equity, and sustainable and resilient reuse metrics, and do well, as measured by protecting investor capital, delivering promised returns on investment, closing transactions that create businesses and jobs and tax revenues. Okay, so that's our roadmap. Let's go to the first page of the presentation, which I constructed in a way to serve almost as an overture. And I want to break this down piece by piece, starting on the far right-hand side and then moving counterclockwise. The first element of this overture, if you will, the title, Answering the Bell, a Brownfields Developer's Perspective on Fully Committing to the Market, created by the U.S. EPA for reuse of Superfund sites. So first and foremost, these are brownfield perspectives on the Superfund redevelopment program. The brownfield program was birthed in redevelopment. It came out of the womb looking for real estate to reuse and didn't want to know from enforcement or administrative orders on consent or potentially responsible parties or cross-recovery actions. As an infant, the brownfield program was doing deals, making money for investors, and turning relatively low-risk sites into community assets. Superfund, on the other hand, came into the world with a bat in hand looking for a fight. It was the Wild West when Superfund was born in 1980. It took 19 years for Superfund for Superfund the enforcement program to discover it had another set of superpowers, this one more likely to bring people together to navigate around and through disputes and morph into something much more collaborative. Those in the brownfields world know a fellow traveler when we see one, and the Superfund redevelopment program has set a buffet of opportunity for redevelopment principals, practitioners, and stakeholders, and as the title of this presentation would suggest, is ringing the dinner bell in a myriad of ways. So we're going to explore what this buffet looks like in the presentation and the many reasons why one should heed the bell and fully commit to all of this redevelopment potential as represented by the country's portfolio of sites in the Superfund program. Moving a little to the left, you have a representation of the of the 20th anniversary report on Superfund redevelopment. As I mentioned earlier, this was published last year, so we're now in our 21st year of the program. This document is featured prominently on the title page because it is the single best testament to how EPA has shed its old reputation of being a program focused on sticks and sticks, the enforcement first model, to one that is much more heavily carrots and honey, and how specifically, objectively, and measured in clear and compelling metrics and detailed case studies, this particular approach works. And then finally, to complete our setting of the stage, we have two counterpoints. First, a cash register receipt of the economics of Superfund reuse, which you can also find in the 20th anniversary report. Money is where the rubber meets the road. If you don't have a viable economic case, you're finished before you start. Superfund redevelopment has thankfully, helpfully, overwhelmingly a lot to say about economic viability. And frankly, it's why we are here today, because the model works. It works massively well, is measured by a wide array of the metrics that investors, developers, lenders, and elected officials need to see to justify the decision to greenlight any development, much less the development of a Superfund site. And second and last, I've included as a placeholder for the softer but still critical side of Superfund redevelopment, that which provides community benefits that are not necessarily directly economic or that hit a developer's bottom line, but are more social and relate to found or expanded opportunities for wellness, conservation, recreation, a closer connection to the natural environment, and that can create equity for neighborhood stakeholders to help longtime residents anchor in place and increase their quality of life. I like to think of this painting from 1884 from my favorite artist, George Seurat. Neighbors and friends enjoying open space in the shadow of a factory district as one of the earliest brownfield portraits on record. Okay, and with that said, let's get into the presentation. These next two slides, I'm actually going to start with the second one first, try to articulate the brownfield's value proposition, the proposition generally for utilizing state and, of course, federal environmental redevelopment programs to justify investment of private resources and take on what can be a very challenging proposition. I'm not going to read all of these bullet items, but some of them clearly merit emphasis. First and foremost is the ability to unlock and access the intrinsic use, location, and the demographic value of a site that may be sidelined by all of the environmental uncertainty and risk. It's this dynamic, this factor, which creates the economic viability, the found value of environmental redevelopment and why it's become such an increasingly accepted business proposition, again, notwithstanding a tremendous amount of risk. Other aspects of the brownfield's value proposition, the reuse itself provides a funding mechanism for cleanup, monetizing the site in a way that far exceeds its acquisition price, provides the dollars that one would need to pay for cleanups that may currently not have any financially viable responsible party to take responsibility. These are the classic orphan shares in Superfund parlance. And to help this process along, of course, we have a massive array, a broad array of financial and regulatory incentives. We're going to discuss a lot of those today on the regulatory side at the federal level. Beyond the scope of this discussion are all of the wonderful state incentives that may be available, tax credits, tax refunds, low interest loans, loan guarantees, and the like. I'll put a shout out for my home state, the state of Florida, where we've got a robust array of financial incentives that makes the economic side of environmental redevelopment pencil out quite nicely. You also have a historically high level of support from developers, lenders, businesses, community-based organizations, environmental justice and public health advocates, and neighborhood residents, many of whom are identified in the graphic to the right of the bullet items. And then if we go back to the first slide, we have the balance of what I like to characterize as the Brownfields value proposition. This type of approach and all of the regulatory buy-in and commitment tends to stabilize private and public capital, which means investors are more willing to commit. The undertaking also provides a broader catalyst for greater redevelopment efforts beyond the subject property. The ability and the opportunity to accelerate environmental remediation and create a development scenario for a long sideline or challenge site usually brings along with it a tremendous amount of sustainability and resiliency-based design, engineering, and construction. And as we will see when we go through these slides, there is all kinds of found equity for non-principal stakeholders in the way in which private-led redevelopment projects bring in neighborhood residents, not-for-profit groups, and allow them to benefit from the economic opportunity and the way in which local resources, whether they be cultural or physical, are enhanced. Let's talk a little bit about some of the economic trends that exist. We've got a series of five slides now that try to survey the landscape and put Superfund redevelopment in a larger current and very practical economic context. What I want to do is I want to start first with the bullet items on the left. The rapid evolution of who was actually involved in brownfield redevelopment speaks to the health of this program and the likelihood that significant dollars will begin to flow into Superfund redevelopment. Back in the mid-90s, the first type of interest we saw in environmental redevelopment was from the entrepreneur, the individual who had excess cash, could bet big and lose big, and had a high level of risk tolerance. These folks were not so much into collaboration or community outreach or equitable development, but getting in and out of real estate deals. Around the same time, we saw the rise of the accidental brownfields developer. These were typically local governments who unwittingly acquired impacted sites and had to fight their ways out. And from that point, we saw the rise of the strategic brownfields developer and the programmatic brownfields developer. These typically were large private and public companies that had to continue to build to expand their pipeline of development to stay in business. Think Walmart, think Target, think Home Depot, think some of your industrial developers, and they were running out of clean land to build on, and accordingly they were early accommodators to not only the challenges but the opportunities that existed at the regulatory level. And then finally, today, we see again a more opportunistic class coming in, but instead of on the entrepreneurial side, we see it on the private equity side, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being moved into the center of the table for environmental redevelopment. Best-in-class brownfield assets have long been those listed here from my perspective. Low-hanging fruit, typically gas stations, more difficult but higher returns with landfills, golf courses, and finally, and this is where Superfund redevelopment plays into the mix, those sites which offer the largest canvas, highest degree of difficulty, and the biggest social impact and give back are becoming increasingly viable and attractive. Of course, Superfund fits that bill. And then in terms of hot reuse exit strategies, industrial, warehousing, and storage make a lot of sense. Logistics, residential on the multifamily side, both affordable housing more so, market rate less so. And then you have retail, which has always been strong and continues to be strong. A neighborhood retail now more than big box as a result of what's happening in the internet and the way in which America's purchasing habits are changing. But there are still a number of big box users who need big sites, and they're running out of clean sites to build on. And then municipal entities are forever reusing impaired sites, including Superfund sites, as we shall see, for recreational and park reuse. And then on the right hand of the slide, we see what EPA is continuing to do, which is to make great progress in its brownfields program as measured by properties assessed, properties cleaned up, a phenomenal number of jobs leveraged. This dollars leverage number is exceedingly exciting, $33.2 billion in private sector capital leveraged by EPA's relatively modest investment, direct investment comparison. And then also impressive numbers for, in terms of properties made ready for reuse and acres made ready for reuse. So those trends continue to be upward and reflect a healthy acceptance in the development community of environmental redevelopment. Going to the next slide, for years and years, in the 90s and in the early to mid 2000s, there had been a concern about whether debt would ever be readily available for environmentally impaired sites as a result of a notorious case out of the 11th Appellate Circuit, Fleet Factors. I like to think that, and as do many others, that that problem has been solved. The debt equity lock has been picked. There is a reason for that, that lenders are no longer running scared, and that's because of the major steps that EPA took to correct that problem. Through supporting federal legislation, providing statutory protection for lenders, as well as putting out administrative guidance clarifying when specifically lenders can finance environmentally impaired sites and maintain their secured creditor exemption or protection from enforcement. And that level of success is evidenced by the number of national and regional and local lenders who routinely provide financing for environmental redevelopment. I've listed here just a handful of the larger banks that we typically run into on environmental redevelopment projects, and their concerns are no longer threshold concerns, existential concerns of should I even be here, but rather give us the information we need so that we can get to the closing table. That's on the debt side. And then on the equity side, we started to see in 2015 tremendous interest from private equity out of New York, out of Chicago, out of San Francisco, and from overseas looking to get into this arena. And you can see the numbers increase from 2015 going from 8 inquiries to 31 inquiries last year in our little shop. And then separately, we have a fund that we're raising with private equity that speaks to how readily available these dollars are as a result of the steps that EPA and EPA state partners have taken to make capital safe. And then if all of that wasn't sufficient, the private market has responded with insurance products to safeguard environmental capital. I'm going to scroll through some of these slides. These next two slides are key, and they were taken from a presentation that I did in July when we attempted to look around the corner and anticipate how the recent winds of change, what I call Brownfield's winds of change as a result of the Black Lives Matters movement and COVID, how those winds would impact on environmental redevelopment. And for purposes of this conversation, I think what we're going to see and how this impacts on Superfund redevelopment, number one, those developers who had concentrated for years exclusively on the urban core, on building up cities, now have to and are starting to rethink having all of their eggs in that basket. And so there is now this reflight back to build out in the suburbs and to build on agricultural land to respond to an ever-increasing demand for new housing, for affordable housing. So what we think we're going to see on the brownfield side, I know we're going to see it on Superfund side, is more suburban land, more agricultural land being consumed for housing starts, most of which, some of which, most of which that is left will have some moderate level to some significant level of environmental dysfunction. We think this creates more opportunities for environmental redevelopment of Superfund sites. And then, as reflected in the second cutout on the screen, we have an election coming up. I'm sure that's not lost on anyone, especially in light of last night's debate. And regardless of which side wins, we see a doubling down on federal incentives for promoting returning manufacturing to America, which means that we are going to need more industrial footprint for all of our new manufacturing facilities, which means likely that we will be reusing our old industrial footprint, including hundreds, hopefully, of Superfund sites that are waiting to be reused for this purpose because they have the existing infrastructure, they have the existing zoning, they have the existing workforce. We think that's an important macroeconomic trend that will play out and lever up the use of the Superfund redevelopment program regardless of which party wins. What I want to do now is I want to get into the Superfund redevelopment program, and we're going to do that by looking at this inset from the 20th anniversary report. And I want to do that for a few reasons. Number one, because it reflects not only graphically, but narratively and numerically how prevalent Superfund use has become across the country. You can see on the left-hand side of the page that there is Superfund redevelopment literally in every state in the country. Now, a lot of it is focused in the Northeast, but plenty of it is in the Midwest and the Southeast with a liberal sprinkling on the West Coast. I expect as the program becomes more well-known through this venue and others, we will see some of the other states where there has been incidental Superfund redevelopment. I think we're going to see that pick up. On the right side of the page, what we see is the Superfund site reuse by type, both narratively and numerically. Over the past 20 years, 408 sites used for commercial purposes, 377 for industrial, 281 for public services, 264 for residential, et cetera. Based on some of the macro factors that I covered a few moments ago, I think over the next 5 years, that industrial number will soon overtake the commercial number. And I think we're also going to see the public services number and the residential number increase dramatically. Public services, especially if we see a massive infrastructure bill out of Congress, which I hope we do. And on the residential side, the demand for housing, for new housing, especially for affordable housing, is so great that it will be impossible to avoid not only the low-risk sites, the brownfield sites, But the higher risk sites, the Superfund sites, because of the huge canvas for development that these sites present. A word about the Superfund Task Force final report, which came out in September 2019 as a result of the EPA administrator's request in May of 2017. What I want to focus on here is that the recommendations that were rendered in this report came out in, were segregated into five categories. Four out of the five categories, and you can see them reflected on this page, the first, the second, the third, and the fourth, are mainly, if not exclusively, redevelopment focused. It's only the second one, or 20%, that has an enforcement element. And of that enforcement element, you can just, you can see it in the title alone, reinvigorating responsible party cleanup and reuse. There's still a reuse element even within the enforcement element. So the Superfund Task Force, the report that they rendered, based on my accounting, is at least 90 to 95% focused on opportunities and solutions for redevelopment that are separate and apart from enforcement, which is a huge sea change in the way in which this program was birthed and why it's been so successful in bringing voluntary parties to the table with significant capital to, without having to be prodded, take up the mantle of redevelopment. This next page just presents some additional metrics. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it, from the 20th anniversary report, Superfund redevelopment report. And I include it because, again, as I said at the top of that presentation, what I'm trying to do is curate the resources for folks who are new to this program so that you have the ammunition to go back to your communities, to your elected officials, to your principals, to your partners, and demonstrate that the program works. And the way in which the program works is demonstrable and is measurable. There's no better way to do that than to talk about money. And so that's what this next slide looks at, the economic side of Superfund redevelopment. This aspect of Superfund, of EPA's website, the portal for which I captured just a portion and included it on the left-hand side of the slide, is it's exceedingly content-rich, and you could spend days navigating it and still not find everything that you could possibly want. But this is a very good place to start. There are a few elements here. The first is the general portal, which I just covered. And then if you go to the right-hand side of the screen, what you will see are these very exciting numbers that speak for themselves. Starting back in 2011, this matrix tracks sites and reuse with economic data, number of businesses, annual sales, jobs, annual employment income. In 2011, there are 135 sites in reuse, supporting 271 businesses, generating $10 billion in annual sales, supporting 24,000 jobs. Now, fast forward 8 years and look at how those numbers have expanded by orders of magnitude. We go from 135 sites in reuse to 602 sites, 271 businesses to 9,000 businesses, $10 billion in sales to $58 billion in sales. This number is very exciting, 24,000 jobs to 208,000 jobs, and $1.8 billion in employment income to $14.4 billion in employment income. What I typically hear as an initial gut response from lenders, from investors, from local government officials, from community stakeholders, is that no one, not only would no one want to reuse a Superfund site because of the risk and the uncertainty, and the headaches and the grief and the cost, no one has ever done it. Well, these numbers put the lie to that, and should be where you turn to first to generate the support that you might need, whether you're a private sector principal or a public sector advocate. And then finally on this screen, what I want to point to is just one of literally hundreds of case studies that you can find through this search engine. It's in one sense, it's cherry-picked because the numbers are just stunning. But in another sense, it's another ho-hum day at the office, because each in their own right, each redevelopment story in their own right, in its own right, tells a very dramatic tale of economic success, revitalization success, equitable development success. And we're going to get into that in a few moments when we go from the economics of Superfund redevelopment to the planning aspect of Superfund redevelopment. This particular case study looks at the Reynolds Metal Company Superfund site, which I think, someone correct me, this could have been in Oregon. I should have included the city and the state. In any event, this particular site now employs 3,500 people. 3,500 people providing annual employment income of $176 million with an aggregate property value of over $238 million, generating over $1.5 million in annual property tax value. For those who argue that Superfund sites are a black hole from which there is no escape, you need only point to this case study. We're going to talk about planning in a moment. I've talked a lot about economics and macro and microeconomic trends, but first and foremost, our job, I say that collectively, everyone on the phone, whether it's EPA, a state party, a local government official, a private sector private sector development principal, or a community advocate, our collective job is to ensure that no matter how wonderful the economic return is, reuse of a particular site is safe. There are legions of stories that have been written, each more heartbreaking than the last, about the reuse of environmentally challenged sites that did not take into account all of these exposure factors, long-term, short-term, during the redevelopment planning process. I include as a cutout at the bottom of the screen an epic piece, an odyssey really, published by the New York Times last month about just this particular dynamic, the reuse of low-risk non-NPL sites as well as NPL sites in a way that didn't properly address the health issue from a safety perspective and how communities have long been dealing with it and will continue to deal with those poor health outcomes for generations in the future. The document that I've cut out on the left-hand side of the screen from which the narrative is taken is one of the best planning documents for novices and veteran developers, Superfund redevelopment planning for the future, protecting public health and the environment. And these are just some case studies from that same document. Also measuring, this is an earlier accounting of Superfund site reuse by type in the lower left-hand corner. And then there's some more summary information on the site-by-site example in terms of jobs created, contaminants of concern involved, and reuse types. Finally, with respect to this document, EPA has thoughtfully included a document by document guide to reusing contaminated sites based on land use and exit strategy. Agricultural land uses, community health, renewable and alternative energy, golf course facilities, commercial waste, commercial use, recreational opportunities, at abandoned mine lands, as well as generally. a quick word on alternative energy projects at Superfund sites, because I think that this is another opportunity that we will see for increased consumption and utilization of Superfund sites. This document, released just about a year ago, succinctly summarizes how well-suited certain Superfund sites are for a variety of alternative and renewable energy projects. It lists every single renewable energy project at a Superfund site in the country by type and provides some project-by-project information regarding the amount of energy generated and some of the other challenges involved. And then in the right cutout, lower right-hand corner of the slide, I've included this document from the Brownfields world, Brownfields Revitalization and Climate Vulnerable Areas, community-based examples for improving ordinance regulations, development incentives, programs, and projects. This is important because it emphasizes the cross-pollinization of program resources and how important that is to project success, that the Superfund world can't live without support from the opportunities and resources and learning available in the Brownfields world. Okay, let's talk about planning. I promise that this conversation will be heavily focused on planning because a lot of EPA's resources are focused on planning. The document on the left, the Superfund Redevelopment and Community Revitalization Redevelopment Planning, four keys to success. These are four important takeaways: engaging stakeholders, building capacities, analyzing information, developing plans, facilitating partnerships, making projects happen. Thankfully, EPA doesn't just provide that type of 40,000-foot guidance, but has generated dozens and dozens and dozens of planning studies that demonstrate how those principles have been successfully implemented at other projects. And those summaries come out in a variety of flavors, three of which I've included on the right side of this slide. You have a reuse planning summary, a reuse framework, and a reuse assessment. Each is a little different, but the bottom line is the same. This is objective validation of how implementing those four keys to success actually leads to intended outcomes. I'm hopeful that we'll have time at the end of the presentation for maybe Bill Denman to circle back and talk a little bit about one of the most important tools in the toolbox that are available for collaboration between private development principles and EPA. That's the Superfund Ready for Reuse Determination guidance. This is a fact sheet from 2004, which seems like it was a million years ago, but I confirm for purposes of this conversation that it's still very, very valid and in play and in place. This shows a deep understanding by EPA of what the marketplace will require to get investors, lenders, lawyers, and others on board and supporting the project. And I only want to read one aspect of this and then we'll move on, but it's an important piece. Under the second question, what is an RFR determination and what is its purpose? The Ready for Reuse Determination is an environmental status report that documents technical determination by EPA in consultation with states, tribes, and local governments is applicable, that all or a portion of real estate property can support specified types of reuses, of uses, and remain protective of human health and the environment. This determination is intended to aid the real estate marketplace by making an affirmative statement written in plain English and accompanied by supporting decision documentation that a site identified as ready for reuse will remain protective as long as all required response conditions and use limitations identified in the site's response decision documents and land title documents continue to be met. Now, that is a great segue into what I think is actually the most brilliant component of this part of the Superfund Redevelopment website, and that is internally, EPA has curated a set of redevelopment tools based on who you are and who your constituency is and what you're intending to do. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, you will see under Find the Redevelopment Tool that works for you, if you are a developer, click here. If you are a local government, click here, and so on and so forth. And what I've done is I've snipped just what a few of those links click through to and some of the resources that are provided. Now, we didn't have a lot of space on the page, so there's a lot more under each category of user than what I've included here. For example, I am interested in recreational reuse. When you click through and it opens up on your screen, you'll see 10 or 11 or 12 different documents focused specifically on recreational reuse. We are getting deep into the planning and technical side, which is what I wanted to accomplish most. This particular document, which I referenced before, emphasizes, again, planning. It's in the upper left-hand corner in the right-hand, on the right-hand side of the screen, the lower right-hand side. This is a cutout from that document. And here, the takeaway is if you are intending to have any level of success on a Superfund redevelopment project and you have community stakeholders, which you will have because that's the nature of the Superfund program, there are resources that are available for those community stakeholders that can run independent of what the development team may be able to bring to the table. Technical assistance needs assessments, community advisory groups, technical assistance services for community for communities program, the Superfund Job Training Initiative, which we love. And by utilizing these additional resources and empowering the community to act on its own and not having to rely on the development group itself, you create not only more transparency, but a higher level of trust. Okay. I want to start this next slide. We're still on the planning side with a quote from Bill Denman this is quoted with permission, correct, Bill? He's probably on mute. But we had a planning call last week.
Yes, you can quote me on anything, Michael.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Thanks. Bashful. So this was Bill's admonition to the larger development community that do not be reluctant to call on EPA to bring to the table and utilize all of the resources that EPA has developed. And the resources are really incredible and beyond what you might think. These are tools and undertakings and activities that as a private developer, one might think one would have to pay for and procure one's own self. Not the case. If you look at the second page of this three-page document that I've included, what you will see is a listing of the technical assistance services that are available from EPA at EPA's cost as part of their investment in a successful collaboration. Community engagement services, interagency facilitation and coordination, redevelopment planning, which itself consists of a reuse situation assessment, a reuse assessment, a reuse plan. And if you go to the third page, the investment that EPA is willing to make goes even deeper. Real estate type owner and prospective purchaser assistance, GIS analysis and maps, title searches, appraisals, desktop surveys, institutional controls research. We mentioned earlier the ready for reuse determination. EPA has an army of land use development professionals that they can bring to bear to solve some of these very difficult problems commonly encountered at Superfund sites related to integration of the remedy with the exit strategy and some of the land stewardship obligations that will be required to ensure that whatever remedy is put into place is protective. And one thing, one particular aspect of EPA's investment in this type of undertaking is its willingness to rethink its own remedy to accommodate redevelopment. You will see that as you go through the case studies, that EPA has historically been willing, for example, to move the location of a cap if that would benefit the redevelopment, which is not to say that they will always do that, but they've done it before. And again, go back to the Bill's quote, don't be bashful. There are lots of ways that EPA can support a project, many of which, not all of which, are represented in guidance documents and case studies published by the agency. And so what I would suggest, what I've seen in the past in working with EPA, is that the extent of their willingness to be of assistance is the extent of your of one's imagination, the extent of one's being able to articulate what one needs is the outer limit of where EPA is willing to assist, which is to say it's almost limitless. Okay. I like to give concrete examples, not just highfalutin talk. These next slides are extraordinary in that they reflect how deeply and intimately involved EPA can get into, and the Superfund redevelopment program can get into, reuse of NPL sites and other types of sites within the Superfund universe where there's a need and where it would benefit the project. The site that we're going to talk about very briefly is the Northridge Estates Operable One site in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Okay, this was a 125-acre site in a residential subdivision located about 3 miles north of the falls. The U.S. Department of Defense operated a base on the site for just a short period of time during World War II. And then from 65 to 77, a partnership of private individuals owned the property. A lot of things happened subsequent to that, not many of which were good. A large part of the property ended up in receivership. But then, starting in 2013, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative started to support reuse planning. What they did here is they developed Let's go back to the first page. The document referenced on or reflected on this slide, the Northridge Estates Phase 2 Planting Plans and Illustrations document, okay? This was a document with renderings to illustrate how site properties were anticipated to look before and following cleanup. The renderings showed how the neighborhood would look after removal of 900 native pines. And the document helped local stakeholders visualize the cleanup process and changes to the landscape during the cleanup process. It also showed shared proposed planting plans and facilitated future use discussions with local stakeholders. EPA then came in and seeded all of the excavated properties, including properties managed by the receiver. They planted trees and shrubs on properties using the landscaping rendered in the reuse planning document. They provided support to capture resident input on plant species and placement to inform remedial design. They designed conceptual planting plans for 11 privately owned properties and 20 receiver managed vacant properties that were going to be put back into reuse. In addition, a site-wide rendering and 6 property illustrations depicting structures, plant plantings, and landscape growth projected 5 to 10 years following remedial action were developed. Now, if that wasn't enough, there was an outgrowth of this investment in terms of equitable development and the way in which the larger community benefited. Here's how. Local contractors provided 80% of the project's labor services. Most materials used in the cleanup were supplied locally, including 80% of all gravel, fabric, soil, and protective gear. The project also provided broader community benefits beyond those just mentioned. For example, in 2016 and 2017, 30 area residents successfully completed EPA Superfund job training initiative. So it's a spectacular story and shows how EPA's planning assistance can be levered up to create other community benefits and more equity for all involved. This document is a series of documents, series of slides rather, is a representation of another excellent planning document issued by EPA. I mentioned at the top of the presentation that some of these resources not only discuss the sequences or the individual elements associated with a Superfund redevelopment project from beginning to end, but how to properly sequence them, and that's what this document does. I commend it to your reading after the presentation. It takes you step by step through how to properly conceptualize and execute a document. Running out of time here, this is the legal section. I'm going to defer a lot of this to Matt. There's some very good resources here for not only project principals, but their lawyers. This initial document is one of the most famous and widely used and well-used documents on the legal side and on the development side. It almost presents an existential set of questions. Why are we even here? Top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. EPA, several years ago, I believe the first edition of the Revitalization Handbook, which addresses not only liability concerns, but statutory solutions for those concerns, as well as administrative. I believe the first issue, the first edition came out in 2014 or 2016. It's been updated several times since. Beyond the handbook, EPA, as it has done elsewhere, has a very robust database and engine, search engine, for all of the enforcement tools that are available to address liability concerns for stakeholders, all sitting around a redevelopment table, whether they're tenants, whether they are concerned about exposure to petroleum releases, in addition to the federal statutory and administrative protections that exist to shield one from liability, the private marketplace has also responded quite well, and there are plenty of insurance products that are available even on the Superfund side. We've placed several of those. This second slide provides a thumb to the wind estimation of what one would be looking at in terms of premium based on the terms of a policy and the duration of a policy and the deductible. More information regarding administrative and statutory opportunities for limiting exposure to environmental liability at Superfund sites. This last, or second to last node, emphasizes the imperative to be transparent about environmental risk and environmental redevelopment and engage in collaborative planning with local stakeholders. These three documents are key. In terms of bringing additional dollars to the table that may be available not only at the state level among not just EPA, other federal brownfield partners, but at the state level, this is a wonderful document setting the stage for leveraging resources for brownfield revitalization. This is a wonderful cookbook for engaging with local stakeholders, Brownfield Stakeholder Forum Kit. This is a little-known document in the environmental redevelopment world. I haven't seen it cited elsewhere. I like this because of the very modern and social media savvy strategies that the document offers up for transparency and risk communication. And then finally, an additional set of planning documents for meaningfully engaging with community-based organizations, local stakeholders, environmental justice advocates, We hear a lot of late about equitable redevelopment. I tried to touch on that in passing in this presentation. We could spend days on equitable redevelopment alone. These two documents, one more well-known than the other, from my experience, present the most readily understandable and translatable and scalable case for equitable redevelopment. The one on the right, equitable redevelopment of petroleum brownfields for Zuni, Pueblo, and other tribal communities, intuitively doesn't seem to apply, but the concepts are very sound, and I have found them to be relevant, applicable, and scalable. Scalable downwards for low-risk sites like brownfields, and scalable upwards for more higher-risk sites like Superfund sites. Finally, in the last few moments, I want to talk a little bit about Goldstein-Kite Environmental Redevelopment Partners. I mentioned toward the beginning of the presentation that we have seen a sea change in the nature of the parties involved in environmental redevelopment. We started with the entrepreneur seeking to execute on opportunities. But we then had the accidental developer, the strategic developer, the programmatic developer, and now we're seeing private equity come in a very large way into this space, looking to take advantage of the efficiencies and the predictability created in the marketplace by EPA's commitment and by the commitment of state partners. And we're following in their footsteps by raising $250 million to acquire both brownfield sites and Superfund sites. In terms of our strategy, as suggested by all of the EPA planning documents and the planning sequencing documents covered a few moments ago, we start at the end with our end use, and everything else flows from there. We're swimming with the current market-wise, so we're very much focused on some of the brownfield macro trends and micro trends that we discussed also in the earlier part of the presentation. We are going to be looking at very large Superfund sites for industrial and logistics development and also for development of housing. We value engineer cleanups through opportunities in site development, which also picks up on a key element of Superfund reuse, which is integrating the remedy with the reuse. And then we've got some of these other elements here, only a few of which I want to emphasize in the closing moments of my presentation. Number one, don't be intimidated by stigma naysayers. We see this all the time. We see it in the brownfields world. We see it in the Superfund world. The facts, the metrics, the case studies do not bear this out. If you have a reuse that makes sense and you have intrinsic value in the real estate, the fact that it was or may remain under the oversight of the Superfund program is not going to be a hurdle or an impediment to closing a transaction, to interesting and engaging end users in being at your project, to closing deals with subsequent buyers, subsequent tenants, and or to finding the resources needed to create equity for local stakeholders in the form of access to conservation, recreation, wellness, their own funding sources for development or capacity building. And I would also point out that EPA has looked at the valuation issue scientifically, programmatically, objectively on the brownfield side. There are several studies published on EPA's website which reflect that a brownfields cleanup will actually increase property values between 5 and 15%. And then this last component very much animates us, very much drives our fund. Think big, bet big, go big, impact bigly. So we are thinking big because EPA has created an environment through the Superfund Redevelopment Program where we can think big, where we can take these big canvases and achieve big results. That type of undertaking requires a huge investment of resources, cash, and time, and reputation. But we're willing to do that because we've seen the results. Hopefully you've seen the results in all of the materials that I presented and in the links to other materials that I provided you with. The EPA Superfund debt always pays off. In Vegas, the house always wins. In Superfund redevelopment, the country always wins because the outcomes are uniformly spectacular. So we're thinking big, we're betting big, we're going big in part, not in full, because our portfolio, our target portfolio, includes lower risk sites like brownfield sites. But we're looking to impact bigly. We're looking to impact bigly in the sense of the return that we provide to our investors, but we're also looking to impact bigly from a social perspective, from an equitable development perspective, so that everyone, not just our little group, can enjoy the benefits that flow from investment of so many public resources. And if you look at this a cartoon that I've included in the on the page here, it's interesting because it's a reminder to us that we have a solemn responsibility to not just pursue profits, of course, but we are responsible for putting families and businesses and schools on sites that were once considered very, very risky. And even though the site may be outstanding as reflected by the sign, there was still at one point an outstanding environmental issue, an environmental impediment, and a public health impediment, which is why the site is still available and the opportunity still exists. And that's not something we want to or are willing to overlook. Other important elements, which I'll conclude with, of our fund, in addition to the reuse component and the exit strategy and our obligation to return superior results for our investors, we very much believe in engaging with stakeholders. Every project will have a stakeholder transparency plan. We believe in equitable development. Every project will have a community equity creation plan. And Bill's words will be ringing on our ears forever in the Superfund context. We are not going to be bashful because, as this presentation has demonstrated, there is an embarrassment of resources and tools available to local governments and the private developers who want to put their shoulder to the wheel and take up the laboring oar of bringing these sites back online, eliminating risk, eliminating public health threats, accelerate restoration, and spark tremendous economic return. And then finally on this slide, here is our favorite scene again from George Surratt. This is an element of our project, of our projects that we hope to incorporate as much as we can, conservation and recreation, in the shadow of former industrial use or other use that has left a legacy of pollution. And in terms of where we are going to be active, we're limiting initially this fund to Region 4. It's not just because Bill is beautiful and brilliant that we're focused on Region 4. We feel that the markets in the development markets in Region 4 are spectacular. And we also love all of the hard work that EPA Region 4 has been putting in for so many years into Superfund redevelopment. We feel there's good infrastructure. There is a tremendous storehouse of history and information at the project manager level and at the senior management level that will benefit our projects in any of the EPA Region 4 states. I think, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, that EPA Region 4 initially developed the prospective purchaser inquiry process, which is...
That's correct.
Go ahead.
You're right, Michael.
Right.
Yes, you're correct. So, we did. Back many years ago, and thank you for bringing it up, and would love to hear your perspective on it.
So the PPI process is the most efficient and quickest way to arrive at a clearinghouse of all of the difficult legal, technical, engineering, environmental, agency partnership challenges that could be associated with a redevelopment project. It is one-stop shopping, and I can't conceive of a reason why a development group wouldn't invoke the PPI planning process as its first coal. I want to just break down really quickly what the PPI process involves. You can find it in summarized in the document I've included on the right side of the screen, EPA Region 4 and Superfund redevelopment, what happens during a PPI. Region 4 puts together a PPI response team, which can include site project managers and technical staff, as well as the site attorney, a cost recovery specialist, the regional lead attorney for reuse and redevelopment, and the regional Superfund redevelopment program reuse coordinator. The response team will schedule a conference call or meeting with the prospective purchaser within 5 business days of the inquiry. During the meeting, the response team summarizes site conditions and cleanup status, available information tools and resources, and landowner liability protections. And there's so much more here. I'm not going to read all of it. You are spoon-fed all that you need to know about a site. This is a concierge service. It is really extraordinary. I've never seen anything like this in government before. And again, Region 4 came up with it. They pioneered it. They perfected it. It's just one more reason why this fund is focusing on Region 4. We love all of our EPA regional partners, but we especially love Bill and his crew. It's in our backyard. And we're looking forward through this fund to adding to the storehouse of success stories that exist. And then my final slide, I'm including some information about the National Brownfields Coalition. For those who like what they've heard and want to see some of these resources expanded and want to see EPA have even more tools and more money to assist communities and stakeholders and developers and elected officials and planning officials, that's what the National Brownfields Coalition is all about. We are policy advocates, and we have been historically active in Congress, and we have a very productive and longstanding relationship with US EPA, which we hope to expand in the coming year to other federal agency partners to lift the professionalism and expertise and expand the resources available to all parties to be even more efficient and economical and productive and successful in the Superfund redevelopment world. And that, my friends, is what I have to say about that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us all today. Just can't tell you how much I appreciate it, you know, and thanks for your kind comments about the tools and resources that we provided. But I just, you know, will have to say that, you know, we've been successful because of innovative people like you that have worked with your clients to, you know, keep them from being scared off by these properties and helping them work through the complicated issues. And, you know, I just can't thank you enough for the work that you've done as an influencer throughout Florida and really throughout the country to prevent people from being scared off by these properties and pointing them to the tools that we have developed and encouraging them to not just write these sites off because of the fact that they, you know, that it's a Superfund site. And, you know, I love the painting that you show. It just reminds me of the latest thing we're working on is we're trying to engage with the land trust community you know, which a lot of times will hold conservation easements or recreational easements. And, you know, we think that they have a large role to play in this as well. So if you come up on anything like that, please let us know because we have some examples. Trust for Public Land is one of our partners already. And, you know, we'd love to extend that to some of the other land trust community. I want to particularly thank you for your shout out for the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Service. We're fortunate enough today to also have on the call Kat West. Kat was an attorney with EPA, a Superfund attorney, a redevelopment attorney that worked with me back in the early 2000s. I remember sitting in her office and we were just, you know, saying that, you know, people call in and they have the same questions and, you know, we need to come up with a way to make sure that we're getting out consistent information to allow them to make the timely business decisions. And honestly, you know, a lot of the questions and conversations either don't result in the redevelopment or result in them saying, you know, well, this isn't right for me. But a lot of times it does. And I think by providing that information, we help give some clarity and, you know, help show people that we are willing to work together as partners. And, you know, I would like to also, you know, re-emphasize the fact, the quote that you put up, not to be bashful. I said that, I meant that. We have a lot of tools available, and it's okay to ask EPA for us to do that. We will help try to determine which tool were best in your situation and try to help you get that done as well. So, again, thank you. Thank you for the kind words. And I also wanted to say thank you for referring to the PPI service as a concierge service. I have explained it many times, and I have never used that term, but I will from now on because I never really thought about it like that, but that's exactly what it is. It's like just going down to the lobby and saying, hey, you know, what do I do? And, you know, we'll be glad to talk folks through that. So, again, thanks for your time. And just to reiterate one other thing that you talked about, to focus on it. When I think of redevelopment or cleanup or, you know, the big picture of what we're doing, I think about it in the world of sustainability or in the world of the triple bottom line, the three-legged stool, the three P's, you know, people, prosperity, and planet. I think hopefully everyone on this call has seen, you know, the three circles where they come together, where we can impact benefiting the environment, benefiting the communities, and also benefiting the economics in the area. And I see Superfund redevelopment as a real key to that. It helps us in our mission. And like you said, you know, Superfund was created. We came out. We were all focused on cleanup, but after a few years, realized that we were not focused on the end use, which is, you know, the real reason to clean up these properties is to get them back into productive use and help the communities heal from having had them in their areas. And to help the local economy. So there are lots of good reasons. It helps protect our remedies. It's part of our mission. You know, please take a look at the task force report if you haven't. Several of us on this call that will be fielding questions participated in the task force, and we really feel like it provides a good roadmap for Superfund redevelopment for, you know, for the future. And like you also pointed out, it you know. This is a bipartisan issue. These tools have been developed under different administrations and continued. I think this is something that Congress and, you know, both parties really support and see the value of. And so we're so happy to be a part of it and so happy to work with people like you. So Michael mentioned some of the tools. I'm just going to put a quick list up here. Some of the things he talked about. We have the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Tool, which we just talked about, that Kat and I first developed back, I don't know, about 2002, and, you know, refined, and now some of the other regions have a similar process. The top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site came shortly after. She and I were sitting in her office saying, you know, we get these questions all the time. Maybe we should come up with a fact sheet. We sketched it out and we're handing it around, and then Matt Sander, who's on the phone now, took it from the national perspective and really refined it and made it what it is today. And so, Matt, we really thank you for that. The other thing I'd like to point out is the revitalization handbook. Matt has been there for all of the iterations of that and is the primary author of all those things. And so, Michael, you can thank Matt for what's in the revitalization handbook. It was just updated this summer, so I would invite everyone to go take a look at that. Of course, the Ready for Reuse determinations that Michael asked me to talk about, those are one of the tools that we can provide to help determine, to help you as a developer, as a local government, as someone who wants to do something with the property, show that it is ready for a particular type of reuse. I kind of reference RFR determinations as the cliff notes of a Superfund site. It just quickly goes into what was there, what was done, why it's protected for a particular type of use. That is useful in a lot of scenarios. We're also a big proponent in Region 4 of comfort letters, which we always offer after conducting a prospective purchaser inquiry call. Those comfort letters have been very valuable, we've been told, for allaying the concerns of lenders. I prefer to refer to them as status letters because, you know, it's really just a current status of where we're at, the current situation of the site, what the proposed use is, how, what a BFPP is, and what liens are on the property, and can, you know, really just give us a snapshot in time of here's where the site is now. But I would encourage you to take advantage of all of these tools. If you're interested, you know, they're, most of them are referenced on our site, and you know, we have some webinars that went specifically into these different tools, so you can look back on the ClueIn website that you used to register. There are some older webinars with specific discussions on these separate tools. Just to give a plug out for some upcoming training opportunities we have, we're rolling out a Superfund redevelopment training on local, specifically geared for local governments. We're going to do that first in November with our EPA folks, and then again targeting state and local governments in December, and then in January we'll be opening one up to the public. So depending on which of those categories you may fall in, you know, I invite you, if you are interested or have a particular interest in local government redevelopment and redevelopment specific to how local governments are involved, please tune into those. And at the upcoming Florida and Alabama Brownfields Conference, which will be held virtually here in a couple of weeks, there will be a session on Brownfield Unicorns, which talks about the Lewisville, Mississippi redevelopment and how Superfund and Brownfield work together to help redevelop an area there. So if you are attending that conference, please sit in on our panel. Okay, here's a link to the task force. I think we've talked about it quite a bit, that we had the recommendations from the task force, and this was the final report. We are still in the process. This is a guide for how the program has moved forward and will continue to move forward. And so that goes into a lot of detail about redevelopment. So if you don't remember anything else, and people have asked, one of the questions was, how do you access the tools? Do you call me? You can certainly call me. Certainly if you're in Region 4, like I said, I'm in the Land Chemicals and Redevelopment Division now, so I'm kind of more focused on Brownfield than Superfund, but I'm happy to put you in touch with the redevelopment coordinators. The most important thing to know first is which region you're in, and secondly, to have this in front of you, because this will help direct you to the redevelopment coordinator in that region. These are sometimes remedial project managers, sometimes land revitalization coordinators, but all of them are your key to accessing the tools that we've talked about, and can help, you know, form site teams and best talk through how to proceed with you. And they are some of the most innovative and hardworking people that I've had the pleasure of working with. And yeah, I'm fortunate I get to talk on webinars like this about the great work, you know, because I've been in this so long. These are the people that are actually doing a lot of this work right now in the Superfund redevelopment world. So feel free to reach out to them if you have further questions, or to me as well. And here's my contact information.
Hello?
Bill, this is Jean. I just wanted to confirm you're still with me on the phones. You may have accidentally muted yourself, Bill. All right. Well, I'm waiting to get confirmation. I know Bill Demmon was just there with us on the phones. I can see he's there, but I think he may have accidentally hit that mute button on the lines. So just for those of you who are noting that it sounded like the audio cut out, the audio did not go out. At least it looks like we may have just accidentally muted one of our presenters. So if you can hear my voice, go ahead and let me know in that little questions box in the bottom. You should be able to hear me on your device. And then, again, if Bill Denman is with me on the phone, if you want to say hello. Looks like Bill is in the process of sort of reconnecting himself, so we should get Bill Denman back here on the phone lines in just a moment. But while we wait to get Bill back on the line, I'm going to just jump in here to assist and remind our audience that they can send in questions and comments for our presenters using the questions box that's now on the lower right of your screen. We know that a number of you have already sent in comments and questions, and we will be pausing to read those out loud here in just a moment. Hopefully we'll get Bill back on the line and he can take over there. But while we're waiting for Bill to get back on the lines, and big thank you to those of you who are chiming in saying that you're able to hear me okay. That's great to get that kind of confirmation. I'll just remind everybody that we do have a few questions up on the screen about potential topics on future sessions and sharing information so that we can keep you informed when new opportunities like this become available. So it looks like I have Bill Denman back on the phone. Michael, I can hear you on the phones, so we are okay there. But Bill, I just want to remind you to hit the magical key command. I'm going to help you out, Bill. I'm going to press a button on my end. And so,
hey,
Bill,
Jean, I lost internet connection.
Got it.
And I guess my phone was, even though I'm on a cell phone, I guess it had connected to the internet, and that was the problem. So I don't see the presentation now.
That's okay.
But I will see quickly if I can get connected back on.
Okay. All right, and Bill, just for your reference, your voice is coming through loud and clear right now. We'll watch to see if we can get you reconnected. If not, we're there to help.
I am. It's coming back on right now. So.
Beautiful.
Sorry, everyone.
All right, Bill, that's okay. We threw up those background questions on the screen asking for future topics and asking those who wanted to stay connected just to let us know how we can reach out to them.
Okay, and I don't know where I cut off, but I think if you came in just when I was talking, then I'd already talked about the tools and the redevelopment coordinators. So was that, did everyone hear that?
We were just starting to hear you talk about contact information and that sort of stuff, yes.
For me? So I just want to make sure that everyone knows that the redevelopment coordinators by region are included in the presentation, and that's the most important thing is to know how to get in touch with them in your region. They can help you with the with the redevelopment questions you have. And then the last slide was for Frank and my contact information. You can also reach out to us. So I'm getting back into the presentation now, and I can look at the questions. Jean, are we ready to go through some of the specific questions that came up?
Yep, I think that'd be a great thing to do.
Okay. Well, before I get started, I wanted to let you know we have someone else on the phone if we need to phone a friend, and that's Matt Sander. I mentioned to Matt when we were talking about the revitalization handbook and the top 10 questions fact sheet. Matt is in the Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement. He's an EPA attorney that works on Superfund redevelopment, on brownfields, on RCRA corrective action. I mean, he really can pull it all together. And so we're very fortunate to have him to help us with any EPA liability questions. Because, I'm not an attorney and I can say all kinds of things, but Matt will help keep me straight and help us with any liability questions. And so, Matt, thank you for joining us and being available to help answer these. And feel free to expand on any of the answers that I give. And, of course, Michael, you as well, feel free to weigh in. First question we got was, is there any particular guidance on deleted sites? And are you aware of any brownfield assessment grants that have been used for site reuse visioning and environmental assessments? So I don't believe we have guidance particular to deleted sites. You'll know that being deleted from the NPL doesn't really do much to address liability concerns. I mean, it's a good perception that we've deleted it, but we can still take actions at deleted sites. The main benefit of being deleted from the NPL is now you do qualify for brown, or you can enter into a state brownfield program, and that's been one of the advantages that we've seen of either partial or full deleted sites is now they're able to get that state liability protection and some of the state benefits after deleted. But I'm not aware of any brownfield assessment grants used for site reuse visioning and environmental assessments. I'm assuming the question was meant specifically for Superfund sites, other than the panel that we're having at the Florida and Alabama Brownfields Conference talks about the Louisville, Mississippi site, where around the Superfund site, brownfields assess some properties, and then on the NPL site, we address that through Superfund redevelopment. And so I think we have a lot of examples where the two programs have worked together in an area, but not particularly on a particular site. And Michael, I don't know if you have anything to add to that or not.
No, you covered it. Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
Okay. Okay. So one, how do you go about asking for the, if you're one of those not bashful people, contact your regional Superfund redevelopment coordinator and, you know, tell them you're interested in redeveloping a Superfund site, and, you know, they can help form the site team and help, you know, deal with those, or get those tools that we have available with you, to you, and see, you know, which ones are most appropriate to use. What kinds of tools are available to ensure continuation of management exposure control measures when the hazard is predicted to persist long term? How does the program ensure that a responsible party won't just walk away from their obligations once they obtain sufficient benefit? Well, first of all, if you are a responsible party at a Superfund site and you have not addressed the contamination to what we call unlimited use unrestricted exposure level, so that's usually residential levels, and this is most Superfund sites, we have some residual contamination left either in the groundwater or the soil may have been cleaned up for commercial industrial use, then we conduct a five-year review every 5 years to evaluate the continued protectiveness of the remedial actions that were taken. That includes a review of any changes in cleanup standards that may occur, you know, as we come into emerging contaminants or to, you know, changes in existing levels for particular contaminants that may be present at the site. So as a responsible party, you have conducted a cleanup. Most likely you have negotiated a consent decree with EPA that has those continuing obligations for you to continue to do work. And that is one of the issues, because responsible parties have this obligation, they have to feel comfortable with somebody else who is coming in as a bona fide prospective purchaser or negotiating agreements with that responsible party, that they're not going to mess something up that then the responsible party would be responsible for fixing. So that's one of the things that we have to make sure is addressed. Or we don't have to make sure. They usually will need to make sure to feel comfortable if they are a responsible party and not the developer. Next question. How do you address environmental justice issues you encounter? Michael, I'm going to ask you to weigh in on this in just a minute, but before you do, I know at the end you put up a couple slides on that, and yeah, I would encourage people to remember the three P's or the triple bottom line, and how redeveloping sites can help address environmental justice concerns. We also have a very robust community involvement program at EPA where we engage the community for comments on the remedy, on future use, and have regular public meetings. So, you know, we're in the community, we're working with the community to address EJ concerns. But Michael, I don't know if you wanted to add any extra discussion on how you would address EJ concerns that you encountered during the redevelopment.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. It's a great question. And the dynamic, the EJ dynamic, doesn't really know from brownfield sites or Superfund sites, right? The EJ dynamic is focused on disenfranchisement, gentrification, disparate and poor health outcomes, and being economically marginalized, cut out from the stream of commerce, cut out from the stream of opportunity. So our approach through the fund, and the approach that I take when I counsel clients, is first go in and listen. Do your research, try and understand as much as you can using alternative sources what the landscape looks like. And then engage. Engage local stakeholders. Engage individuals. Engage advocates. Engage leaders. And do a lot of listening. And once you've identified the problem, don't ignore it. Make it part of the overall project goals. And their expectations need to be your expectations. If there is a concern about being disenfranchised, collaborate on strategies to help local long-time residents anchor in place, which is the opposite of gentrification. if there's a concern about exposure to impacted soil or groundwater or drinking water or sediments or air, empower the impacted individuals, the impacted groups, the representatives, the leaders, to have direct access to their own experts. Provide whatever information you have, make it, and do so in real time and transparently, and in ways in which the information can be readily received. And there are lots of ways to do that, innovative ways, using various social media platforms, as are reflected in that planning document that I referenced in my presentation, Next Generation Cleanup, the Next Generation Cleanup Compendium. And so now what you've done is you have information, an information exchange that is transparent, it's reliable. The community is not necessarily relying on you to tell them what they're confronted with and what the solutions are. They have access to their own information and their own experts. And that's one way in which you build trust and understand how to develop a project that provides returns and benefits, not just for the development group, but for the community. And there are other ways in which to address environmental justice concerns above and beyond the public health issues, which are key, obviously, baseline, and economic issues. There are various ways in which communities can be lifted and their quality of life expanded. There are cultural resources that can be enhanced or funded. There are independent capital mechanisms that can be put in place by carving out a portion of the revenue of the subject project to provide for microlending, or to fund an initiative or a facility that will allow the community to pursue their own independent objectives. These are the kinds of things we think about and try to accomplish in our little world.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate that perspective. And you know, I'd have to say that I would agree that, you know, a lot of times the benefit of what us coming into a community has is that we are able to help the community build the capacity to advocate for themselves to the local government and to other entities. You know, it, of course, to us, we want that capacity. We need that capacity to be able to work with the community on the Superfund redevelopment. But one of the extra benefits of this is now they have they have the structure and the capacity to now even further advocate for themselves and help address some of the issues in those areas. So I've really seen that as a benefit.
Mm-hmm. Bill, there's one other element that I want to discuss relative to the issue of environmental justice here, and it's part of our culture on the fund side, and it's a concept that the Florida Brownfields Association is starting to promote through its environmental justice subcommittee. And that is creating not only a mandate, but an expectation for and among those who are in a position to procure environmental services, that those services will be provided by either in part or in full minority-led firms, or will be provided by, I guess the opposite of minority is majority, non-minority firms that have minority professionals as their project management leads, that those who work on these projects in EJ communities need to be, should be, of the EJ communities themselves. And there's a great way to increase the economic benefit enjoyed by a host community, by an EJ community, and that is by ensuring that the contracting on the environmental assessment side, the consulting side, the contracting side, is through a minority firms and minority professionals.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. That's a great point, and it's one that we really try to encourage through the Superfund Job Training Initiative and other ways. So yeah, absolutely, you're right. To the extent you can bring jobs immediately to the community and they can see that, it is certainly helpful. We have time for just a couple more questions here. If exposure control strategies need to be in place long-term or even permanently, how can we ensure that these controls are appropriately communicated to each and every subsequent owner of the land? Is this a note on the land title or best approach, or are there other effective options? Matt and I and Frank and a lot of the folks in headquarters have been working on institutional controls for a long time, and so Matt, I'll turn it over to you in a second for some input on this, but it's important to know that any person redeveloping a Superfund site or brownfield for that matter is going to want to be a bona fide prospective purchaser, and part of that is conducting all appropriate inquiry, even for subsequent transactions, and that all appropriate inquiry or phase one environmental assessment would show the restrictive covenants or any enforceable restrictions that have been placed on the deed. Now, in those areas around the site where we are unable to get enforceable institutional controls in place, we have been working on that, and so trying to figure out how to best inform people. And so, Matt, I don't know if you want to talk about some of that work. Matt, are you there?
Matt, this is Jean. Oh. I'm going to try to help you unmute yourself.
Oh, I didn't mute count there. Okay.
I got you, Matt. We can hear you now.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. Thanks, Bill, and thanks, Jean. With respect to institutional controls and bona fide prospective purchaser provision, I completely agree with Bill that the all appropriate inquiry, which is like your phase one due diligence, that's critical on so many levels, not only for your as a piece of your liability protection as a bona fide prospective purchaser, but it can help identify those use restrictions on a property. And, because oftentimes some degree of waste is left in place, those use restrictions are just critical. They be complied with, and they come in many forms. They can be part of the title as a restrictive covenant. There might be a deed notice. They might be it might be in the form of letters, zoning, government ordinances. The best institutional controls are what we call layered, where there's multiple notices, multiple avenues, so all future users and current users, are informed of any restrictions. Like, for instance, it might be a restriction, to not dig through soil in a certain area, or, make sure you're careful because there might be a monitoring well there and you don't want to knock that well off. I mean, there's some fundamental restrictions, but I can think of another site out in California where they've got where there's a lot of fishing in an area where there's contaminated sediment, and there are signs put up in multiple languages trying to inform people that, about fishing and contamination. So it's we take institutional controls really seriously. They're just a bedrock of making reuse possible. And it's cross programs, and we've got a terrific guidance document. We've been talking about guidances all day here, Michael and Bill, and that's what we do here. And we've got a really comprehensive guide. We call it the PIME guidance, which just talks about planning, implementation, monitoring, and enforcing institutional controls. And it really, goes through the life cycle of institutional controls because they're just that important to all the work we do, from protecting the investment that either the EPA and or a potentially responsible party has made in cleaning up a site, to also protecting the public and the environment who are going to be potentially avoiding contact and with exposure pathways. So, yeah, thank you, Bill, for raising institutional controls. We're strong proponents of that.
Absolutely, Matt, and I think what you said is key. It's the bedrock of redevelopment, because in those instances where we have not allowed or where there is something that needs to be protective, we need to make sure that the ICs are in place. And we've even done innovative things like instead of developing an IC on a cap that says it needs to stay there, we've developed a cap that was designed to hold up to a certain amount of weight in anticipation of there being, you know, some sort of warehouse or something built on top of it. And so the institutional control for the cap is that you can build on this cap up to a certain amount of pounds per square inch of weight, you know, and for example. So, you know, those are the kind of things we do try to think about the future use when we design the institutional controls, and certainly want to, you know, try to get them in place, and, you know, they would follow any phase one or whatever that was conducted for subsequent owners. So we're at 12 o'clock, so I guess I'd love to stay and talk all day about this, as I know Matt and Michael and Frank and Kat and all the folks on the phone from our end would. But I just want to thank everyone for calling in today and participating in the webinar. And I know I'm going to turn it over to Jean. I think she has some closing remarks and ways to how to access the archive. So with that, I will conclude my portion of it. And again, thank you all for your interest in this. And I just really look forward to continuing to help facilitate the redevelopment of contaminated land, as I know all the folks on this team would. So if you're interested, please get in touch with your local regional redevelopment coordinator, or with me, or with Frank, or Michael, or any of us, and we'll be glad to try to help out in any way we can. So thanks a lot. Jean?
Thanks so much, Bill. All right, I promise I'll keep you for just one more moment. We also want to echo the thanks to the over 180 participants who joined us from actually all over the world for today's live broadcast. We really appreciate your time, as well as for those on the organizational and presenters teams. We appreciate you sharing your expertise and knowledge. I encourage everybody to sign up for our free monthly newsletter at Tech Direct on the website so that you'll be alerted to online training opportunities like this. In fact, the next Tech Direct is going out tomorrow, so you have time to sign up and be alerted as soon as we have additional resources like this available. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, those have been posted. We put a copy of the link on the additional resources tab on that seminar homepage. It's under related URLs on the middle right. I've also included it right into that questions box on the bottom right for everybody. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found on that presenters tab. And then, of course, for those of you who can, please take a moment to fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, one of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs, and while we don't issue those types of credit hours, we can give you a certificate, something like the screenshot here. The only way to get a certificate is to fill out the feedback form for today's session. Now, you can fill it out whether you're watching the live version or you're watching the recorded version. So for those of you who have played this back all the way to this point, just follow that link to that seminar feedback form. Again, you'll find it under related URLs. Click it and then press the Browse To button to open it, or just click the link in the questions box. Fill out that feedback form, and then make sure you enter your email address correctly and that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session. As long as you complete those two steps, as soon as you fill out the feedback form, it will immediately then present you with a seminar certificate that you can save for your own records. And I do encourage you all to either print it out or save a copy for yourself, because I have to go back in and regenerate them if you lose them. If you happen to have multiple people joining at your particular location, please know each person can fill that form out on their own, even if they didn't register individually. So if you're the person who signed up and invited others to sit with you, please simply send them the feedback link and then let them fill it out to get their own certificate for their own records. And again, I just wanted to echo the thanks to everybody involved in today's webinar, and we hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. With that, we'll go ahead and